You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of All in the Mind. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, Julie Browning here with this week's All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Today, what Australian schools are doing to tackle the problem of teenage anxiety, and some of the latest research suggesting the brains of young children can be altered by trauma.
Some children are willing to tell you their stories, and sometimes they can tell you the story in a drawing. And sometimes they'll tell you so much of the story, and then they'll clam up. Sometimes you see it almost a dissociation symptom where they just become mute for a while because they're so upset. And sometimes as the kids start to talk about the story, they get so anxious. I once interviewed a child. When we started talking about the physical abuse, he decided to hide under his chair. He told me the rest of his story under his chair because that's where he felt safe. The important thing is to be patient with them and very flexible with them and to let them talk at the rate that they're comfortable with.
Dr. Michael DeBellis, and he's from Duke University Medical Center. He studies the effects of maltreatment on the neurobiology of the developing brain. Studies show that when little children and adolescents experience neglect, abuse, or witness violence, they're at risk of post-traumatic stress. But there is little neuroimaging research into the neurobiological effects of trauma and post-traumatic stress in children. And this is where Michael DeBellis' research fits in. His initial study suggests that traumatic experiences can have adverse effects on the brain development of small children. So are children or adults more prone to post-traumatic stress? Michael DeBellis is with Natasha Mitchell.
Children are actually at much higher risk to getting post-traumatic stress disorder once traumatized than an adult. And actually, most of the work that was done in that area was here in Australia, with Sandy McFarland's study of how people coped with the Australian bushfires. And he basically found that the children had much, much higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than the adults.
Introduce me to some of the children that you've been working with to give us a real sense, if you like, of how post-traumatic stress disorder manifests in children.
Children experience the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and many of the symptoms are similar to adults, with some exceptions. In children, the intrusive re-experiencing of a trauma, instead of constantly thinking about the trauma or having flashbacks of the trauma, which is what you would see in adults, children will play act their trauma. Sometimes children hear voices of the person who hurt them saying bad things to them. And sometimes kids get misdiagnosed with a psychosis. Children have a lot of nightmares about the trauma, have a lot of trouble sleeping and insomnia. And sometimes the bad dreams are not necessarily about the trauma, but about a metaphor about the trauma. I once had a child in my study that his parents would fight, and his bad dreams would be about yellow and green ghosts fighting one another. Also with children, sometimes it's hard to assess some of the avoidance symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
What do you mean by that?
You can ask the child what they want to be when they grow up, and a lot of times these traumatized children just may not be able to tell you. And sometimes the older ones will tell you, well, I'm not going to grow up. Some of these kids grow up in violent neighborhoods where they've known other kids who've been killed or killed in gang-related incidences. The other criteria that makes for the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder is hyperarousal, poor concentration, hypervigilance, motor restlessness, and an irritability.
Now, I can imagine that might be confused with attention deficit disorder in children.
These symptoms do get confused with ADHD. In a good evaluation, you'll be able to tease them apart. Because an ADHD kid has ADHD all the time. They have it when they're playing, they have it at home, they have it at school. A child with PTSD, when they're in a relaxed or safe environment, will not manifest these symptoms. These symptoms are usually related to traumatic reminders. Now, having said that, some kids have ADHD and they have PTSD, and you need to treat both conditions.
Your work has been extraordinary. It's focused on the impact of maltreatment on the developing brain and body of little people. And the impacts of maltreatment you found can be pretty huge and very measurable. You started looking at brain chemistry and the body's hormones and the brain's neurochemistry. What were you looking at there and what did you find? Because this all connects to what you've since found, which is that the structure of the brain can be impacted too.
We were studying cortisol responses in girls who were sexually abused compared to non-abused girls. We basically found that their cortisol responses and the other hormones that regulated cortisol were abnormal.
And let's just clarify, cortisol is one of the body's main stress hormones.
Yes. From my work there, I decided to become a child psychiatrist. Since then, I've studied kids who had post-traumatic stress disorder, boys and girls, who've been abused. And what we found were their levels of catecholamines, which are some of the major stress hormones in the body, and their levels of cortisol were much higher.
This is well after the abuse, so they are carrying higher levels throughout their day than most kids.
These elevated levels of stress chemicals were higher well after the abuse, so this is most likely a change in their baseline functioning.
So is this a case of children being hypervigilant all the time? It's a sort of permanently hypervigilant state, if you like.
It's a permanent state of increased arousal, so it's a permanent state of a bodily response to stress, which is, if it continues to go on long term, can cause major health problems. Many of these stress hormones affect brain development. So the other area that we studied were these children's brain development, and we basically found that children who've been abused who have PTSD had smaller cerebral volumes and cerebellar volumes, which are the...
So their brain is smaller.
Their brains are smaller. And the younger they're abused, the smaller the brain. The longer they're abused, the smaller the brain. And the longer they're abused, the lower their IQ. So these are very, very worrisome findings.
Let's come to some of the specifics of those findings and the parts of the brains that you zeroed in on. But I'm interested in, we all have a sense intuitively, but also it's known that stress is an ageing force. And people talk about premature ageing in little beings that have been abused. And I guess that's more than metaphorical then, if you find these higher levels of stress hormones throughout their life as children.
There's some work going on in the 1940s and 50s basically suggesting that stress causes premature aging. And it may be what's happening in the brain of these children. We don't know. We know now that there's neurogenesis in the human brain, and that's a recent study.
And that's neuron growth.
Neuron growth in the human brain, and that's recent, and it's a somewhat controversial area. But we know that stress inhibits this growth, so it's quite possible that kids who grow up under chronic stress, under any type of chronic stress, will have some adverse brain development.
Now, you did a very well-known study now, but you're still working on all this, where you scanned the brains of boys and girls, a group that had been diagnosed as having PTSD as a result of maltreatment, and then a group of kids that didn't have PTSD and hadn't been maltreated, so in a sense a control group. What did you find in their brains? How were they different?
The children who had PTSD secondary to maltreatment had smaller brains, smaller cerebral cortex, smaller cerebellums. And the younger they were abused, the smaller the brain. The longer they were abused, the smaller the brain. There's an area in the brain called the corpus callosum, which is the area that integrates the right and the left hemisphere.
And in fact, to give people a physical sense of that, it's a thick band of nerves that connect the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, right there, smack dab in the center.
We found that the corpus callosum is smaller, and the more symptoms of PTSD they had and the more symptoms of dissociation they had, the smaller was that area of the brain. And that's very interesting because that's the area of the brain that integrates information. When you think about a symptom like dissociation, dissociation is the failure to integrate your memories, your current experiences, and your thinking and your perception.
And that's what you're seeing in children who have been abused.
Yes.
So that's a smaller brain volume in different parts of the brain, but you also found in some parts of the brain that they were larger. Can you tell me what they were and why you think they might be larger?
Actually, there are two areas. One was the hippocampus, which we haven't published yet. The hippocampus is involved in the encoding of new memories. It's involved in memory and spatial relationships. So it's involved in your memory of the time and the place of something that happened, versus the amygdala, which is involved in the emotional part of that memory. So we found that that area is larger, and we found that an area called the superior temporal gyrus is larger. That's an area of the brain that encodes facial information and social information, an area that encodes the intention of others. It's an area that's involved in the science of theory of mind, where we can understand what another person is thinking based on their behavior.
You also found that the ventricles in the sort of center of the brain, on either side of the center, were larger. Now, they're essentially gaps. They're not brain tissue, are they? That adds to the idea that there is less brain in kids that have been abused.
The interesting thing about that finding was it was only in males. It was only in the males that had post-traumatic stress disorder. It was not found in the females. And again, that's a worrisome finding. We see larger ventricles in very serious psychiatric illnesses, and we see it in an aging population. So we'll see it in individuals who are in their 70s and 80s.
So this is really adding to that premature aging idea again, isn't it? Tell me, it's a complicated one, but did you compare children that had been maltreated who had PTSD with children who had been maltreated but didn't have PTSD? Because I guess in all this, there may be a whole range of different factors that can make a brain smaller, and it might be socioeconomic, it might be poverty, it might be nutrition. It might not be maltreatment.
That's a very, very important question. Right now we're actually running that study. It's very, very hard to do these studies. So when we did the first study, and the idea was we compare the healthiest kids to the kids who had PTSD but were medically, you know, healthy. And if we saw a difference, then we would go back and do further research. If we didn't see a difference, then that told us to look at other impacts of stress on the brain. When we did our first study, we did not match for social economic status. We picked the healthiest kids from the healthiest families with the children who had PTSD but were able to live with a non-abusing parent. In our second study that we published in 2002, we did match for social economic status. Our results were the same.
Now, what you're pointing to here is that abuse can mean that the developing brain is somehow truncated. Can you translate for me some of the observations that you've made in the brain into the way in which these children behave? You know, for example, what does reduced brain volume, what could it mean in terms of behavior for these kids?
Our findings of reduced brain volume, maltreated children with post-traumatic stress disorder, have a lot of implications. The children have smaller frontal lobes. It means they may be more likely to be impulsive and to get into a lot of trouble. They have conduct problems. Smaller brains go along with a much lower IQ. So it means that they'll have a harder time in terms of supporting themselves and doing well in their future.
This is tricky though, isn't it? Because I sometimes wonder whether imaging studies of today have the risk of being kind of the phrenology studies of the past, and I say that with due respect, that you can say, well, that kid's got a smaller brain, they're doomed to a low IQ. I mean, is that a risk in all this?
That's another very interesting point. The work that I've done is very preliminary. It doesn't tell us a lot about the mechanisms of how this finding affects behavior. It basically is a very worrisome finding that we need to follow up on. It's very important to review the results with caution. All the brains in our study, every child had what a radiologist would read as a normal brain. And our results are statistical. What we found was a 5% smaller brain volume. It's not a large percentage. So you can't tell from looking at one brain and looking at another brain whether or not a child is doomed to fail. The other interesting thing is that women have 10% smaller brains than men, and men and women have very similar IQs.
Dr. Michael DeBellis from the Duke University Medical Center. He was with Natasha Mitchell. I'm Julie Browning, and you're listening to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Michael DeBellis's research indicates that not only can the developing brain be negatively affected by trauma, but once that trauma is removed, the flexibility of the brain makes it possible for some repair. This restorative capacity of the brain has all sorts of implications and adds scientific weight to the need for programs to assist children and teenagers. And we're going to journey away from the lab now to see what's happening in high schools. We know that the teenage years are a time of heightened emotions, where our private world, what is going on in the mind, can feel overwhelming. Most teenagers experience intense feelings of anxiety and sadness, as well, of course, as great feelings of joy. And in Australia, some world-leading programs are being instituted in high schools to provide ways to help teenagers cope emotionally when faced with adversity. Resilience is the buzzword, trying to encourage skills so teenagers can bounce back from difficulty. Mind Matters is a mental health prevention program for secondary schools, and it's funded by the federal government. It's been running for about 5 years and tries to support schools in helping kids. Jo Mason is the national coordinator of Mind Matters.
Our idea, I guess, through this kit, which was developed by a whole group of academics from health and education backgrounds who had a close affinity with schools as well as with research, was that we would really build young people's resilience. We would also seek to talk to organisations like schools to really sort of build up, I suppose, their capacities to enable that sort of thing to happen through their structures and through relationships, even allowing time for relationships with people to develop so there are levels of trust, obviously, so people can go and get help. Now, I mean, that's coming from research overseas and here to indicate that rather than only teaching, if you like, towards and naming problems, that if you also take and work from people's strengths, that you build those strengths, and that starts to have an effect. Obviously, it moves across. It doesn't mean, you know, obviously that you don't think about suicide prevention, but it means that you're starting from perhaps a slightly different starting point. It's a long range, I think, plan in many ways. And you'll find too that much of the work, I think, in suicide prevention has for now for some time in Australia incorporated this health promotion approach.
It reminds me of that analogy of the wings of the butterfly, that it's kind of like a rippling effect, and that's what the approach is, that you start something and you hope to see that ripple effect continue to, in this case, bolster a child and a teenager's self-esteem and sense of themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather a nice image. I also think, I mean, it comes from, you know, a strong understanding of human nature as well. If you're really trying to get people to perhaps change their behaviour and things along those lines, you don't move towards perhaps the pointed end by pointing out a problem or a fault or a difficulty. You actually start from where people are and you build up, as you say, people's confidence and self-esteem and move from there.
How do you advise teachers and counsellors on some of the signs to look for in a case of a teenager who seems to be suffering from depression and quite severe depression?
We don't. What we do is, going back to your other point, is that we talk about teachers doing their job well is one of the most critical things, and having those relationships in perhaps making space within the curriculum or doing two things at once. If they have a curriculum outcome, they think about some of the health and wellbeing orientations that they might do. They might have a slightly more active methodology, a different way of doing things, and so they engage students. They might decide that they're going to, instead of obviously having students all working individually, that they'll do more group work and encourage connections, and then really draw out from kids, you know, how it's important to listen to other people or, you know, other helpful behaviours along those lines.
When you discuss and think about the school and how the school can incorporate this material and the approach, I know that you think about the whole school. Maybe you can just discuss that, what it is, what this whole school approach is.
We all know that having the right teacher sometimes who's operating in a great way with our particular student makes a huge difference. However, I mean, teachers also need to be sustained by having structures within schools. But I guess a whole school approach is when you start to examine what would be the experience for students and for teachers, and how can we improve that further? So you might have a look at, you know, the way that you incorporate health and wellbeing topics with students. You might have a look at school camps so you can encourage close relationships. You might talk about the training and development that you offer teachers. You might talk about some of the structures or ways that families and carers can come into the school. You might talk about student government a little bit more and student leadership, because when students, you know, have a sense of being involved and participating, they feel like that they've got a contribution to make to schools. They, you know, they have a sense of making a difference.
And more research needs to be done.
I think so, yeah.
Joan Mason, National Coordinator of Mind Matters, thank you very much for joining me on All in the Mind.
Thank you.
Anyone else here? It's a brief poem written by Tennyson in the 19th century. Did you get it? You were the one that had the story of the bird, weren't you?
Yeah, but then I was peer pressured in the
Really? You should have stuck to your guns. You were right in the first place.
The Mind Matters approach works in tandem with other state and territory strategies. In New South Wales, a program called School Link runs mandated courses with school counsellors on how best to work with students. Anthony Hillen is a statewide School Link coordinator, and he told me that although the program is in its infancy, it's only 6 years old, he's hopeful that the resilience model is working.
It's such a good news story with resilience. It's the idea that some young people are able to bounce back from life's adversities. The good part of that is that we can teach some of the skills and help young people develop their social connectedness so they have this ability to deal with life's difficulties. And schools can play a huge role in that. And they already do, often without realizing it, but just with a bit more consciousness around that, they can fulfill that job much more effectively. For instance, some of the key skills in resilience are problem-solving skills, skills to deal with conflict, relationship skills, ability to talk about feelings and emotions and to recognise your thoughts and to deal with stress. They're kind of things that can be worked into the curriculum, things that schools are already doing. And Australia's produced some great programs to assist schools and teachers doing this. There's programs called Resourceful Adolescence, RAP, and Adolescence Coping with Emotion, ACE, which teach young people these things in schools. Sometimes they involve the teachers in doing that, and sometimes they're integrated into the curriculum for schools that are interested in doing this.
Yes, because schools have to choose to be part of it, don't they?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And what is the evidence that working on the idea of resilience and how to improve teenage resilience across the board works in helping teenagers to stop feeling depressed or feeling less depressed?
Well, there's quite a lot of evidence, and it's been increasing, particularly over the last 15 years. We've been seeing a bit of a shift in psychology away from the old model, I guess, of looking at deficits and concentrating on pathology and things that people can't do, to be much more interested in, well, let's look at those individuals who are able to cope with life's challenges and what can we learn from them, and can we give some of that to people who struggle with things. And there's a great project called the International Resilience Project, who have a wonderful website that lists all their research and evidence, and there's things there that are relevant for parents and teachers and a range of different professions. And initially it started in North America, by people who are concerned about education, and also in the UK, looking at young people coming from difficult backgrounds, maybe where there was deprivation, poverty, maybe poor parenting, maybe parental mental illness or drug and alcohol issues, and finding that about a third of young people growing up in that circumstances seem to thrive and do really well in spite of the adversities. So they did a big international study, many sites around the world, looking at what these young people have in common. And they distilled 15 factors that the resilient individuals seem to have in common. And some of them were to do with skills and competencies, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of problem-solving skills, ability to deal with conflict, relationship skills. And the other big group of factors was to do with social connectedness. So this was young people who felt they were loved and valued and they had a role and they were important and they mattered. And there's more and more research coming out demonstrating the effectiveness of these factors and the fact that we can effectively teach them and foster those connectedness factors in schools. So some schools are integrating this now into the curriculum.
The issue of depression is one where we're looking at it more keenly. Obviously, things such as School Link and trying to work with teenagers in the school is relatively new. What longitudinal studies are being done or can be done to kind of track their efficacy, their usefulness?
Mm-hmm. Well, it still is early days. There is some good research happening looking at the effectiveness. So far, they've been looking at 6, 12 or 18 months out after the particular interventions in schools. So we're finding short-term and medium-term these interventions are effective and they're working well. We're finding that young people, for instance, who go through the RAP or the ACE program do have a lower rate of depression or other difficulties 18 months out from the program compared to a control group that just had some other program and non-intervention. But we don't yet have the long-term data because not enough time has elapsed, but there are some projects in place looking at that. So far, so good.
Some groups of teenagers are at particular risk of clinical depression and suicide attempts. These include gay and lesbian teenagers. But even with this vulnerable group, research is showing us that the majority are already quite resilient.
What we do find is that three quarters of lesbian and gay teenagers go through adolescence without any problems, without any mental health problems, in spite of some of the adversities they might experience in terms of violence or harassment at school. And when you look at those young people who are doing well with it, we find that some of the ways they've coped is that they've thought about their sexuality in different ways. They've come to accept it, and they're more likely to say to themselves something like, well, that person's got a problem with who I am, rather than I'm evil or sick or perverted for being this way. So it's almost like they've done a bit of cognitive therapy on themselves. They've changed their thinking around it. And that gives us some useful clues about those same-sex attracted young people who are having difficulties, say, with depression, of the way to help them feel better about themselves.
So it comes again down to resilience and those skills of shifting things around so that you learn how to feel better about who you are and your situation.
Yes, it's the skills, but it's also the connections. And the other big factor, of course, is school environments. And some schools do a brilliant job around bullying and harassment. Not only is that important for lesbian and gay students, but clearly it's important for all students. The most potent factor, it seems, from the research in fostering mental health and well-being of all young people is if they feel a connection with their school. And that means that they feel respected, and diversity is valued and celebrated within that school environment.
Anthony Hillen from School Link, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And it would be great to get your thoughts on this programme, so please email us from our webpage, which of course is where you'll find the transcript of the discussion later in the week. Head to abc.net.au/rn and click on All in the Mind under Programmes. And thanks today to studio engineer Louis Mitchell and producer David Fisher. See you next week.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.